the seahorse. Fragile, mysterious, slave to the slightest current. A fish with the head of a horse, the tail of a monkey, the eyes of a chameleon. A paradox of evolution. We are its greatest devotees, and yet its most voracious predator. Harvested in vast numbers to feed the ever-growing demands of traditional Chinese medicine, this extraordinary creature will almost certainly be extinct within the next 20 years. Millions have been spent trying to avert this. Every effort has failed. One man refused to give up.
And he is sitting in front of us. That was the voice of John Hurt. What a brilliant, brilliant voice he has. That was a documentary which featured on RTÉ television. We spoke about it here last year. Save Our Seahorses. Keelan Doyle, excuse me, is a marine biologist. Keelan, welcome back to the programme. So you're still on a mission to save the seahorse.
Still going.
What is going on?
Still here. I think it was 5 years I was here, first of all, telling you that's what I was going to try and do. And we're still at it. I don't think we've fully succeeded yet, but I suppose the question is, when do you ever succeed? But yeah, I mean, basically what we've done is we've set up a charity, a campaign essentially called Save Our Seahorses, mm-hmm. SOS, of course. So it's appropriately named. And the overall objective is to try and save seahorses from imminent extinction that they are under. We carried out research where we travelled around Asia several years ago, and basically we were the first Western people to ever get access to traditional Chinese medicine factories, to deal with the fishermen, to deal with the retailers. And basically we came up with the conclusion from a report that there was in excess of 150 million seahorses a year being used in traditional Chinese medicine. Now, bearing in mind that CITES and the World Health Organization has estimated that the number was 20 million.
All right, now just to remind people, CITES is the Convention on the International Trade of Endangered Species. So these are listed as an endangered species. You need a license to trade them, to move them from one country to another, over borders, et cetera, et cetera. Isn't that correct?
Exactly.
And they reckon there was only 20 million.
Exactly. They reckon there's only 20 million. And I suppose, bearing in mind that the people who are involved in their trade realise that it's something that wouldn't be very popular. So they really don't want people to know how many are being traded in. So as a result, when Mr. or Mrs. CITES comes along to do the inspections, obviously they're very careful about what they tell them. Mm. We went there under a different guise. We went there as people who breed seahorses and people who want to help them and get involved in them. So they were very open, they were very honest about what they do, and they showed us their figures, they showed us the factories. So we got to see firsthand, and this was actually covered in the documentary. And what we seen was amazing. I mean, we've seen bags upon bags upon bags of dried seahorses. I mean, literally like bags of coal that were laid out for the fire. It was frightening to actually see.
I have a million questions in my head. First of all, why can't you farm seahorses? Is it possible? And therefore, look after the business and the trade like that, so you don't have to take them for the wild. And then if they are doing that, well, why are they taking them from the wild? Is a wild one better than a farmed one? And then what are they doing with them anyway?
Well, what they do, right, and I brought a couple of samples in, they use them for a whole variety of purposes. They're used for mild depression, they're used to cure insomnia, baldness. But the number one reason why seahorses are used in traditional Chinese medicine is they're used as natural aphrodisiacs, okay? And I mean, for example, one of the samples of tablets I have here, they're called seahorse genital tonic pills. And I leave that up to the imagination.
But do you rub them on or do you take them?
What they're actually for. And I mean, to give you an idea of the ingredients, seahorse is the main ingredient. There's also the cervix of certain animals, the semen of other animals, and the semen of otter, the cervix of deer. So it's a complete mishmash of animals that are
in
these tablets.
And it is a tablet you ingest.
It is a tablet that you ingest. Now, that's a relatively recent market. Traditionally, you bought a seahorse like one of these guys here, and you bought it whole, and you went home and you made a soup or a wine out of the seahorse. Mm-hmm. The benefit of this was that only large seahorses were used for this market. But in recent times, young Asian people, who it's amazing, they're so obsessed with the West in terms of fashion and music and David Beckham's and all of this sort of stuff. But yet, when it comes to medicine, they still believe that Eastern medicine is far superior. They don't want to waste time making soups and tonics and potions and what have you. They want the quick fix, and the quick fix is the tablet. The problem with the tablet is now that the seahorses that were left behind, the small little seahorses, are now used for the tablet market. So essentially every seahorse is harvested, and that's a big
problem. So how much of a seahorse do you find in a pill?
You get, I mean, there's 80% of these pills. So the powder it's in that, 80% of that powder is ground down seahorse.
Have you analysed those pills?
We have, yeah. And it is seahorses that are actually in them.
And what? It's 80%. It's 80% seahorse and 20%.
There's the semen of otter. There is the
in the same tablet. Sorry, same excuse tablet. Me. In the same tablet.
Oh, in the same tablet.
I thought
tablet.
You were talking about all these tablets. Oh, yeah. Heaven's sake! Why are they obsessed with aphrodisiacs? Who wants to be hung like a seahorse? I ask myself. But I mean, what's the obsession with that?
The whole obsession with seahorses and aphrodisiacs is that, of course, seahorses stay together for life. So the only reason that they believe that they have aphrodisiac qualities is because of this pair bonding. They believe if they're in some way physically or sexually happy, that if they take the dried form or the tablet form, that this will then transfer to humans and they will stay sexually happy for life.
Keelan, just to ask, in terms of, you said you had a look at the ingredients, but in terms of the actual active ingredients, let's assume for the moment that there is an active component to this. And very often these stories have some, you know, there's some basis for them. Have you looked chemically at the active ingredients in terms of trying to think of some way of, particularly given that we've social media and so on available to these young people, convince them that you could have a substitute that could be equally active?
We've analysed them, and I mean, all we have come up with is that the seahorses are a very nutritious diet. But bearing in mind, there's very little in them. I mean, if you look at them, how they dry, you know, they're generally it's bone. I mean, there's very little flesh in them. What we have found is that they're very high in various highly unsaturated fatty acids. So they're extremely nutritious. They're extremely good for the heart and for various other reasons. But there's nothing in them that we or our researchers or scientists have found that has any aphrodisiac qualities. So I don't think that Viagra are going to be quaking in their boots that there's going to be a replacement for them anytime soon.
Keelan, it seems an extraordinary choice because this is the male seahorse doesn't want to be a male. In fact, he becomes pregnant, or rather she deposits her eggs in a pouch on his body.
Exactly.
And to all intents and purposes, he behaves like a female. She's the much more active one. She moves around a lot more and all this sort of thing. So it seems very odd that you would invert that you would choose this particular animal who seems to undergo a kind of voluntary sex change for the height of male potency and all that thing. But I remember you being in here 5 years ago. I think I remember you describing going to Kilkee many, many years ago and finding your first seahorse as a diver. Now, what struck me is that, and for instance, there were some 19th century records of seahorses, but people did not really believe there were any seahorses off the Irish coast when in fact they were there. But you said, yes, you could show and demonstrate that we have seahorses off the Irish coast. Now, the interesting thing about that is, if it's so hard to even find and prove that a seahorse is there, how can you possibly go out and harvest vast numbers of them? How do they do that?
How they do it, and you're right with everything you say. And, you know, yes, there is, first and foremost, there is actually two seahorses that are found around the Irish coast, primarily found around the southwest and the western coasts, in areas where it tends to be a little bit warmer because they're at their limit temperature-wise. Also in areas where there's lots of seagrass because that tends to be their preferred habitat. In terms of finding them, they're an extremely cryptic species. They're very, very, very hard to see in the wild. And I've, you know, known many experienced divers who have dived and who are right beside a seahorse and they can't see that it's straight in front of them. You struggle to see them in an aquarium at times. And of course, this is how they survive. They're not particularly good swimmers. How they survive is that they don't get seen. Okay. Now, when you go out to areas where they live in, the problem is that they tend to live in shallow areas which are very accessible. So they're not like cod or something that you need large equipment and boats to actually go and catch them. These are something that's very accessible. So whether somebody is 5 years of age or 75 years of age, they can literally get into the water, they can snorkel. And it's amazing to see how basic the conditions are. For example, the goggles that they use where I was based was coconuts with the top of the coconut cut open and the top of plastic bottles put in so they could view out through, and they would snorkel down and eventually they will find the seahorses. And, you know, what was really tragic was the areas that we visited, and we went all over the Indo-Pacific, you would talk to fishermen and these guys were catching 40, 50, 60 seahorses a night 10 years ago. Now, if they catch one, they're lucky. So this isn't something, these are animals that have existed since the time of dinosaurs. This isn't our grandparents and our great-grandparents. This is during our time that these guys are being wiped out. And that's the problem.
I think, Keelan, though, I was in China there 2 years ago now. And in the area I was in, everything you've said is paralleled by other fish species. So that's part of your problem, I think, in the sense that this has almost become the norm, where they're almost fishing to extinction and certainly going from one species to the next, which is something we used to do in the long distance past here in terms of our sea fisheries. But hopefully we're more enlightened now. But certainly it strikes me that in the context of trying to solve the problem, that banning this is actually not going to work. So in terms then, if it was a fish, and if I was advising, if you like, in terms of the fish management of this, first of all, I'd ask, are there a number of different species here? Is there one of those species that's particularly resilient in comparison to the others? Is there any way then of dividing out the grounds so that people could be educated as to which particular species might take the pressure, whereas others wouldn't? And then see if you could get people on board to try and divide the cake so that there would remain a fishery, but that the fishery would be regulated biologically to try and make sure you got the bounce back from the species that were actually in a position where they could actually make inroads into a repopulation structure very quickly.
It's very good points, and it's good questions. And I suppose in answer to the first point about China and the different species, I mean, what's happened in China is there has been an economic boom that's been unprecedented, and the global recession has slowed it down, but it hasn't stopped it. So it's essentially like what's happened. Seahorses, weight per weight, would you believe, are more expensive than gold in China at the moment. And what's happened is that basically, like the Celtic tiger in Ireland, where in the past only the very wealthy people could afford seahorses. Now what's happened, like the Celtic tiger in Ireland, where people, you know, everybody was having their Jeeps or their holiday homes or whatever they were having. Now the middle class can actually afford seahorses in China. And this has become a huge problem. So the demand, the market demand has increased massively. So it's a problem that has grown so quickly. And every time we go back, we see the demand has increased. And this is something that Chinese have used for thousands and thousands of years. It's something that they believe in. For example, if you go to somebody's house, the biggest form of welcome that they can give you is offering you soup or wine that's made from seahorse. And the bigger the seahorse, the bigger the welcome.
Isn't that a reflection on your virility?
Well, exactly. It is, you know. And that's the issue. So you're trying to go against, first and foremost, something that is ingrained in their belief, and something that all of a sudden the market demand has increased exponentially. So it's happened very quickly. That's the first problem. The second problem is how do you tackle it? Okay. And we've tried to look at it in very, very different ways. And we've tried to go at it from a sort of a four-pronged approach. The first approach, and it's very similar to what you said, is fishing practices, okay? We've seen from our research that 92% of male seahorses that were fished were pregnant, okay? If you look at that example or sample I've brought in there, that seahorse is male and is pregnant, as strange as it may sound. But we then have put in place in various projects in Cambodia and in Indonesia, where what happens is that the fishermen will catch the seahorse and they put the pregnant male into a cage where he then remains for a week to 2 weeks until he gives birth. So the fisherman still has his catch. He still takes the male seahorse. But the numbers of juveniles, which range from 20 up to 4,000, have been given birth and are now free to swim in the ocean. So that's one example of how changing fishing practices. Obviously, there's lots of more examples that can happen. This was something that was very easy and is very simple. And we've showed on one particular location how it has worked very, very well. So fishing practices is number one. The second is marine reserves. Now, we have set up the first two marine reserves in Cambodia, and they've been approved by the Cambodian government. It's taken us about a year and a half to get this. And as people know or may not know, essentially a marine reserve is a no-take zone where you cannot fish the species that are within it. And of course, what happens there is that the seahorses and the other fish, they give birth, and that helps to repopulate the surrounding areas. So the fishermen have now seen how their catch has increased, not just in seahorses, but in other species. And while they were very against it initially, they now are in favour of the marine reserves, and they actually police it against potential threats from sort of foreign fishermen, namely the Vietnamese fishermen. So they're the first two main sort of reasons what we have put in place. And I think it's sort of similar to what you've talked about.
Yeah, well, certainly. I mean, I a friend of mine runs a marine reserve in New Zealand. And that was exactly the same pattern they found, was that in terms of the marine protected area, huge resistance at first. And now the fishermen very much welcome it because it's a fantastic recruitment area. And not alone are they getting more fish, but they're getting much bigger fish. And it's also drawn in an incredible amount of people visiting the area. They saw it as a barren area, an area where they could do all the research. Nobody would be interested in going in there. The children are actually going in there now and they're swimming with the big fish. And they never thought about that. They never thought about the effect it would have in terms of bringing people around. So I think that's probably the way to do it.
So ecotourism, Ken.
Ecotourism, yeah. Well, and it's an interesting example. But I think in the context, having been there, in the context of China, I think we're way off of that. But I do think the important thing is people don't want to run out of seahorses. And you mentioned that earlier, that really industry at this stage must be aware of the fact, even though they're going to make a short-term gain out of high prices, they can't run out of these things. So there's probably an opportunity now to try and talk sense into them in terms of some sort of management regime.
Well, the Chinese, what's very refreshing is that the Chinese authorities are now starting to work with us. They're starting to implement the fishing practices. They're aware of what we've done in Cambodia. And what we're also doing, which is what you mentioned, Eric, is about cultivation. What we have done in Ireland over the last 14 years is that we've developed a method to commercially cultivate seahorses. Because what I felt and what we discovered when you visit these areas, that it's not just about saving the seahorse. It's about saving the people and the communities whose livelihood is completely dependent on the seahorse. They don't have other options in most cases. And if you want to save seahorses, you know, it ultimately comes back to money. Can we bring money into the locality? Can we give them an alternative income source to taking them from the wild? So the marine reserves has helped. The ecotourism we have now set up in Cambodia, where what happens is people come and they pay to scuba dive and to see the seahorses. That does two things. It's bringing money into the locality. And they're actually, we have researchers and scientific officers on the ground. And the students, the people who pay to dive with the seahorses are actually carrying out the research free of charge for us, because when they're diving, we have survey work and what have you. So we're getting the essential scientific information that we can now put in conservation plans. The locals are now starting to realise, hold on a second, these seahorses are actually worth more to us alive than they are dead.
Yeah, but there'll be still a need for them, because this sounds like it's deeply ingrained in the psyche of Chinese people in particular, because you said there it's because the seahorses stay together and they take this not to make them better lovemakers, but to keep their relationships together. Did I misunderstand you, or did I understand that's what you were saying? That they believe in some way taking this aphrodisiac, it'll keep them together with their partner for life.
Exactly.
Which is to be respected and admired, that they want to stay together for life, actually, isn't it?
It's to be respected. And also,
but they're going to continue to take it.
Also, just to be aware,
continue to want it.
The Chinese, I mean, this isn't a sort of an anti-Chinese, a campaign. This is something where I think the reason we're starting to have a lot of success is that we've approached it and approached the Chinese to say, listen, guys, you have a problem. You know, you're not perfect, just like we're not perfect back in Ireland or wherever else. We have the knowledge, we have the ability to help you with this problem. So, for example, the Chinese authorities are now coming up with an advertisement campaign to look at alternatives to seahorses as natural aphrodisiacs, so that they can, in particular, try and persuade young people, because this is all about the youth. If you can get The campaign we have set up, what's amazed me is the amount of young Chinese who are now supporting us and who are looking to change. The older people are obviously more, you know, conservative and they don't want to change.
Yeah, who's taking it? Are the older people taking it?
The older people,
what
traditionally,
age profile?
Like the young people take it as well, but traditionally it's the older people. And like, it's fascinating to see it. And the famous saying in Chinese medicine is ginseng to the north and seahorse to the south. Now, the north and south being the waist. So the ginseng is good for the mind and the body, where seahorses are good for the waist down, as in for the natural aphrodisiacs.
Are people taking it into their 60s and 70s?
Oh, yeah.
What's the name of the little blue pill that everybody was running around trying to get their hands on at one stage?
Viagra.
Viagra. Is it seen as Viagra?
Oh, it is. This is their Viagra.
But it's not doing that for them.
Exactly, but it's placebo. They believe it's doing it.
It's the same with the rhino. They want rhino horn for aphrodisiac purposes. They want the parts of big cats, tigers are annihilated to satisfy this market. Ivory. So as well, I don't think we should be reluctant to criticise the Chinese. This is a sort of thing. The Chinese are coming into the West and they're changing and so on. We should be hands off them. We would criticise the Americans very fast if they were doing something like this. I wanted to ask you about the husbandry. Your husbandry, you apparently were the first person in the world ever to raise seahorses in captivity. That's a rare distinction. Now, the ones you raised were presumably Irish ones. Now, there's something like 50 seahorse species in the world. Will husbandry work equally well with Cambodian and Chinese seahorses? Have you tested that?
Yeah, I mean, we have, at this stage, we have raised 26 species of seahorse. So the vast majority of the seahorses, both the cooler water species, which the Irish would be one of, and the tropical seahorses, which is what we mainly want to focus on. So essentially, it's down to the natural food. The bottleneck, or the answer to cultivating seahorses, was down to natural copepods, natural plankton. And that's why I originally came back to Ireland, because, of course, we have the Gulf Stream and a very plankton-rich waters off the west coast of Ireland. What we then focused our research, initially it was harvesting this food, which was fraught with danger, because, of course, it's seasonal. You may get lots of it in the springtime and none of it in the wintertime. You also have the issue of maybe introducing disease when you take it from the wild. So with the universities in Ireland, we had a research programme and we developed the technology to cultivate that food. So whether we're in the west of Ireland, or whether we're in the Red Cow in Dublin, where we're at the moment, or whether we're in Cambodia, we can cultivate the plankton. And that's the secret to growing the seahorses.
So the copepods, it's copepod husbandry is the problem.
Exactly.
Not sea part. Well, if you can provide the community of crustaceans, the seahorse will be fine. But you can do that even with Far Eastern crustaceans.
Exactly. Exactly.
But the copepods have to be alive. It's live prey is what is demanded?
Initially, it's live copepods. But once they sort of start feeding on them, relatively easy. But what we do in Cambodia, just so you know, we actually try and use the live food as much as possible, because the conservation project we have set up is twofold. One, they are growing and selling the seahorses, so it's bringing income in. The second thing that they're doing is that they're actually releasing some of the seahorses back into the wild. And that's a potentially dangerous thing to do, especially if they're fed on dried foods or if they're cultivated off-site. But they're cultivated in pens within the seagrass beds, using live food from first generation seahorses. So there's no genetic issue, there's no potential disease issue. So the seahorses are being released, the locals are getting income, the ecotourism is happening, so money has been brought in. And essentially what we've shown in four locations now is that what we said we could do, or what we wanted to do, we have now done it. And we're now in negotiations with a major, major international fund with a view to get an investment of over 100 million euros, which will be used to roll out this programme right across the Indo-Pacific region. So it's very, very exciting and very promising at the moment.
You're going to be very rich. But I'm just thinking, I mean, if you're giving them live food and they're on the seagrasses, the natural seagrasses, when you release them, are they able to find their own food?
Exactly.
Is there enough food there?
Because they're in, like, you don't release them all in the one area, because they don't swim very far. So they will be released in different areas. And even in terms of the release, we have a very exciting target, because the Cambodians have really taken us to their heart. Now, this isn't a commercial, this is a conservation project from our perspective. But the Cambodian government have really sort of warmed to this project.
And they're given 100 million. There has to be a reason they're given 100 million. I'm not being funny.
They want
to
see
over 100 million for conservation.
They want to see employment. They want to see wealth being generated in these areas. But they also want to see a social aspect to it, where there's conservation, where the seahorses have been saved. As I said, if we do nothing here, guys, these seahorses are going to be gone. What our research has shown, that based on current levels of fishing, based on current levels of uses of seahorses, that seahorses would become extinct or technically extinct by 2030. Okay, as I said, this is a species that has been with us since the dinosaurs, and it's our generation who are essentially wiping them out. And, you know, it's happened to so many species. We have an opportunity here to do something with it. And we've now got the impetus, we've got the model, and now the challenge is to roll it out. But things are looking very exciting.
Well, Keelan, thank you very much indeed. And maybe when everything is really up and running and you're doing well, you'll come back and tell us all about it. Or we go to Cambodia and have a look. That sounds like it could be nice.
Or the aquarium in Bray.
Or the aquarium in Bray, yes.
They're starting to seahorse thing, I think, at the moment, aren't they?
Well,
you're probably doing it for them, are you?
And on that, just actually, you know, Cambodia, Han Sang, who's the Prime Minister of Cambodia, the National Day of Cambodia is called Fish Day. It's like our St. Patrick's Day, where basically the Han Sang releases thousands of captive bred animals back to the oceans, back to the rivers, and it's a whole idea of giving back to Mother Nature.
What day is it?
It's in 6 months' time, but he's given us a year and a half, and the challenge is we have 50,000 seahorses have to be cultivated, and Han Sang, the national day will be the seahorse day, and he will officially release them back into the wild. So that's what we're aiming for, and that's going to be huge international PR for us.
We'll be there. Anyway, thank you very
much. With 100 million, certainly we'll be there, won't we?
Nóg dúinis le Caoimhinne Lán. You can visit our website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Keelan has popped back in because quite a few people are wondering, can you keep seahorses as pets? Well, can you? And is it difficult? And have you done it?
You sure can. I mean, the seahorse, they're really easy to keep as pets once they're captive bred. And that's the crucial part. And why they're so easy is, if you think about it, in the wild, a seahorse will attach to probably one bit of seaweed for its life. It never travels any great distance. So as a result, they're extremely happy in a sort of a smaller aquarium, where if you put a salmon, for example, into an aquarium, it would get stressed out very quickly. So the answer is really easy, as long as it's captive bred. And I suppose the little bit of a plug is, to fund our charity work, we actually have our retail, which is Seahorse Aquariums, and we actually supply the captive bred seahorses. But we have a mini training program, and you have to sort of tick the boxes before you're allowed to have your very own seahorse.
What boxes do I have to tick?
Well, you have to have a certain size aquarium. You have to be a...
Well, what size aquarium do I
have? You have to have a minimum of an 85 litre aquarium, and it has
now,
to
how big
have,
is that now? Come on.
It's roughly about sort of 2.5 feet by 2.5 feet.
Okay, yeah.
It has to have certain sort of filters. We use natural algae in the aquarium, because what they do is they naturally clean and oxygenate the water. And there's certain sort of habitats and certain tank mates that you can only put in it. So, for example, we try to put only captive bred animals. So captive bred clownfish, which we also breed, and stuff that goes on well with seahorses, because seahorses are very slow to feed. So if you put them in an aquarium with big, big fish, they will actually feed quicker and outcompete the other guys, and the seahorses then will struggle to get food. So these are the type of things.
Don't put them in with anything that eats them.
Don't think of anything eats them.
Does anything eat them?
The only thing that eats them,
apart from people.
Apart from, mainly it's people. They have been found in the stomachs of crabs, and they have been found in the stomachs of dorado, which is a sort of a mackerel species. But if you touch them and feel them, they're actually sort of pure bone. There's very little meat in them, so they're not that tasty. So really, it's only humans, I'm afraid.
So did you ever think of keeping them yourself, Rich? Did you ever have anything like that? Ken, did you? You mean you're the fish.
No,
you must have kept all sorts of weird
certainly.
Stuff.
I've had freshwater tanks, but I've never had marine tanks. The only marine tank I was involved with was when I was running a little visitor centre, and we'd lots of little baby ray and so on. But we had, unfortunately, we had no seahorses. But it does strike me that in that context, that certainly it's more or less a specialist area. People wouldn't want to be throwing in a seahorse with everything else. Just to get that point across, I think that's important, Keelan, I'd imagine.
Exactly. I mean, it's something that, you know, we would try and sort of encourage people to have other sort of maybe easier species initially before they then progress onto the seahorses. And, you know, once they sort of have served their apprenticeship, if you like, then they're in a position to sort of take on the seahorse. But they're extremely interactive. I mean, to watch them, the fact that they can move their eyes independently, they change their colour. You know, like a chameleon, the whole camouflage. They will actually sort of hold on to your finger and take food out from your hand. So they're very interactive, and they're just a nice
very calming, I imagine.
Very, very calming.
You know, you can imagine if you had the aquarium up there and just see the little seahorse going across.
We all need a bit of calming. Nice.
Particularly in a restaurant. I think it would be lovely in a restaurant, because sometimes with the fish in the restaurant, they hide. Yeah. But if you had something just there and you could only just barely see it, it'd be very nice.
Eat them in Beijing, because we've just had a photograph sent in from one of our listeners, from Alex and Roscommon, a pic of seahorses on sale for dinner in Beijing last February. I didn't eat one, he says, but I did eat other bugs. Not very nice. And lots of pictures of people preparing and setting and eating seahorses. We've put them on our website, but there you go.
It is, and it is the problem, because, you know, it's they're so easy catch, and, you know, the demand, as I say, is increasing. I mean, the pictures are sort of scenes that I've seen before, but for people who haven't seen them, it is extremely frightening, and it's extremely sad, and it's extremely worrying. And that's why I think the other aspect, which I didn't mention, is awareness. I mean, what we're trying to do with the documentary that John Hurt kindly narrated free of charge.
Which was shown in 40 countries,
It's been shown in 40 countries. They've made an 8-minute version of it that was shown on all in-flight entertainment in China. They've made a 6-minute version that was shown. It's been shown in all sea life centres around the world, including Shanghai. John Hurt, as I say, narrated it free of charge to help the campaign. So it's getting the word out there. It's making people aware that there's a problem, making young Chinese people aware that, hold on, guys, you know, if we don't do anything here, these are going to become the dinosaurs of our generation. This is what our kids will be collecting on the bottom of the cereal boxes, because they will be gone and gone forever.
All right, Keelan, thank you very much indeed.